And our text for the sermon this day is found in Acts chapter 19, verses 21 to 41. Beginning on page 928 in your pew Bible. Now after these events, Paul resolved in the Spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. About this time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way, for a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. And you see it here that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. And there is danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. When they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So the city was filled with the confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. But when Paul wished to go among the crowd, the disciples would not let him, and even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now, some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd, but when they recognized that he was a Jew, for about 2 hours, they all cried out with one voice, great is Artemis of the Ephesians! And when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open, and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another, but if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. And they say the Bible doesn't have a sense of humor, huh? You can't help but read that and smile. We see from this text, as we've seen throughout the book of Acts, that religion shapes culture, doesn't it? We see it here, vividly. For example, let me ask you, why does science flourish in the West, if this is true, and not in the Arabic and Muslim East? In part, historians have attributed much of the reason for science flourishing in the West and not in the Islamic and Arabic world to the intrinsic worldview of the respective cultures. For example, in Islam, one founding Muslim imam named Al-Ash'ari promulgated the doctrine that Allah is completely and utterly deterministic. And that, as Bernard Lewis says in his book, The Arabs in History, every event in every atom of time is the result of a direct and individual act of creation. Now, this ostensibly glorifies Allah in the mind of the Muslim. But in fact, it is a damper on science and inquiry. Abu Hassan al-Ash'ari, 10th century, was the founder of a fundamentalist school within Islam that was to profoundly influence generations to follow, including the radical Islamists of our own day. According to Asharism, there's no such thing as a cause and effect in nature, no such thing as a natural law, according to which man can predict certain results from precedent causes. In Islam, God is at work individually creating all things anew at every moment with nothing in creation contingent upon any other thing in creation apart from the direct intervention of Allah. Bernard Lewis cites an example from the text of Ash'ari that a lack of food, for example, doesn't necessarily cause hunger, but merely accompanies it. Figure that one out. In Islam, scientific knowledge is fruitless at best, sacrilegious at worst. Okay? The worldview of Islam contrasts sharply with the worldview of the West, shaped not only by the foundational inquiries of the Greeks, but also by the spirit of Christianity. The biblical worldview fostered exploration into creation and its workings, trusting that a God would indeed bring continuity of knowledge and inquiry. One of the verses that you see peppered throughout the period of the Enlightenment, for example, among the Christians laboring, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over every living thing upon the earth. Science took dominion of God's creation. Man could inquire into nature's workings, determine how it works, and then master it for biblical purposes. Men like Sir Francis Bacon and Sir Isaac Newton had faith that God had created an ordered universe that his sentient creature, man, was expected to explore and delineate. Some of you are working out at the site. This is a direct result. Your labors are a direct result of scientific inquiry, are they not? And biblical Christianity, as it has explored these things. Even Albert Einstein, who's no Christian by any measure. Einstein was not a Christian, get that straight. He noted this, however, about the Western perspective. I quote Einstein now. He says, I have never found a better expression than the expression religious for this trust in the rational nature of reality and of its particular accessibility to the human mind. Einstein goes on. He says, where this trust is lacking, science degenerates into an uninspired procedure. I submit to you that's precisely how it is in the East, in the Muslim Arabic East. So, do you think that religion has an impact on culture and society? Why do you think that the United States of America went to the moon while Islam only adopts the crescent moon as a figure in their flag, right? Why do you think that the United States of America discovered electricity, created the light bulb, while Islam still rubs two sticks together and relieves itself in trenches? Why do you think the West discovered microbial life, vaccines, and sanitary procedures to stem the tide of disease, while Islam chucks all of these plagues and diseases up to fate, up to kismet, is their word for the deterministic fate of Allah? Our daughter Rachel tells the story of observing an Iraqi local while on patrol with her unit. She said he defecated in the river in front of her and all the world, walked a ways downstream, and then casually scooped up a refreshing drink of water from that river. Who does this in an informed, civilized society, huh? We are so immersed within the stream of our culture that we've forgotten what has shaped us. Not so the Ephesians of Paul's day, though. who first encountered the gospel in their pagan environment. They observed firsthand how the gospel transformed their world. Let's look to this. Look to our text here a moment while we have these remaining moments. The inside flap of your bulletin, you will find 3 points that I would like to make with you. 3-point outline. Some room for a few notes, perhaps. Our title is Impact today. Okay, impact. The gospel has an inevitable impact on the cultures and societies wherever it goes. Impact. The gospel cannot help but transform commerce and custom. Okay, verses 21 to 27. The gospel cannot help but transform commerce and custom. Luke, in his inimitable way, say that 10 times fast, summarizes Paul's long-range itinerary. That is, he's going to pilgrimage to Jerusalem for Passover via our Grecian circuit of churches. And then sometime after Passover, he will bring the gospel to the capital of the empire, that is Rome. Little does he know how events will conspire to get him there, though. We'll see this unfold as we finish off the book of Acts. So anticipating this, he sends his advanced men, Timothy and Erastus. Paul himself lingers there in Ephesus, where he has witnessed to a series of dramatic cultural events. Usually he's in the middle of all these things, but he's kind of on the sidetrack a little bit here, isn't he? Watching these events unfold. He lingers there in Ephesus, witness to a series of dramatic cultural events which, like oxygen feeding a flame, suddenly illumine how the gospel is transforming the culture around it. Not always peaceably. And our antagonist for this drama is a silversmith named Demetrius. The Silversmith Guild of Ephesus had a rotating presidency where a notable practitioner would preside for 1 year, acting wherever necessary in the interests of him and his fellows. Such men had immediate access to politicians, magistrates, religious leaders, due to their economic and cultural influence. Like union leaders of our own day, Demetrius had considerable political clout. And Demetrius is no slouch, is he? He has observed how the gospel preached by the Apostle Paul, this interloper, was having an impact. Right? It was having an impact. By the way, don't say impacting, right? Impact is a noun, isn't it? It's not a verb. Not impacting or impactful. That's even worse. You really want to get my goat and get under my skin. And I realize I'm leading with my jaw here with some of you. Just say that something is impactful. It's like fingernails on a chalkboard. Well, Demetrius notes that the gospel is having an impact on his culture and his world, isn't it? Most of all, on his trade, right? On his means of living. Religious faith and practice always has an impact upon the surrounding culture, wherever it is practiced, not just Christianity. And at its core, at its heart, biblical Christianity abhors idolatry and or pluralism, that is the acceptance and worship of multiple deities. You shall have no other gods before me, is an affirmation that rings across the covenants, doesn't it? Goes to the heart of who God is. Is it any wonder, then, that Ephesians, once soundly converted to Christianity, as we saw last week, burned a fortune's worth of books, did they not, of occultism and necromancy and so forth? You can see why, then, Ephesians, once soundly converted, would eschew the local temple to Diana, all of her worship and devotion, devastating to the cult of Artemis. Demetrius saw this clearly, and his arguments from commerce and custom were 5. Let me review them briefly with you. First of all, Demetrius says, we've got a lucrative gig with this cult of Artemis, do we not? The temple and cult of Artemis was definitive of the city of Ephesus. The silversmiths were the trinket and souvenir makers, if you will, of this cult. Go to New York, buy a little Statue of Liberty. Go to San Francisco, get a little trinket of the Golden Gate Bridge, right? These were trinket makers, if you will, who plied their trade in Ephesus. So even apart from any spiritual consideration is this economic one. Diminished reverence for Artemis. Artemis means diminished revenue for the artisans, doesn't it? Diminished reverence for Artemis means diminished revenue for the artisans. Secondly, he says, the gospel disparages this cult. Wired in its very nature is a rejection of even a smidgen of spiritual reality to our local religion. Christianity, in its very declaration, says gods made with hands, like the ones we make, aren't gods at all. Gonna put up with this? Christianity's primal assertion is antagonistic to ours, Demetrius is saying. There's no God but God, right? It's not 45 degrees in opposition, 90 degrees. It's 180 degrees in opposition to the religion of Ephesus. Demetrius also makes the point that our union is losing respect. You can see a union leader. I grew up in Western Michigan where unions were strong. Sometimes it's hard for me just to not salute unions, even now. I grew up with it in the water. Unions got respect in Michigan. Like all good labor leaders since Jimmy Hoffa, Demetrius recognizes the primacy of respect. Our trade may come into disrepute. That is, lose respect. Fatal in negotiations with management, right? Hoffa lost all respect with the New Jersey Mafia. He's now buried in the west end zone of Giant Stadium, isn't he? At least rumored to be. Demetrius did not want to end up taking a dirt nap in the west end zone of the gladiatorial stadium in Ephesus, losing respect. Fourthly, he says, the temple of Artemis may shrink to nothingness. Demetrius' logic was ineluctable. If this trend continues, our goddess may shrivel to good for nothingness. There was more at stake than commerce, an entire way of life, a whole set of customs held dear because of the goddess Artemis. This was a matter of civic pride, if you will. What would Chicago be without the Sears Tower or the Loop? What is the Windy City without that breeze coming in off of Lake Michigan? What is Ephesus without Artemis? Fifthly, he says, Artemis herself may get bumped down the pecking order. In the ancient world, Artemis, or Diana, as she was also known, was a goddess preeminent. Her image, that is her embodiment, as they say, was a meteorite at one time, fell from heaven. It had fallen to earth from heaven. It was shaped in the image of a well-fed, multi-breasted matron capable of nurturing countless offspring. Therefore, well-fed, many-breasted, extremely fertile, those who possessed her possessed fertility for their culture. All of its women then of the city would be under her influence. Remember, too, not like in our day, once again a product of Western culture and influence, is that our mortality rate is so much higher than it used to be. 2 of 5 children would even reach the age of 12 in this day and age. So fertility, productivity, fecundity was prized in those days, and Artemis was the goddess of such things. So, for Demetrius and his ilk, the gospel of Christ threatened their whole way of life, everything they understood, their whole worldview. In fact, the gospel would go on to shape the way of life throughout this region of Asia Minor. John would compose his iconic letters to the churches of Asia Minor, if the one to Ephesus being one of them. The Roman Emperor Constantine would establish his capital here in this peninsula. This region of Asia would become the heart of the Byzantine Empire with the Eastern Orthodox Church as her soul. So So, the gospel, I submit to you, is like oxygen to spiritual life, like water to thirsty souls, and it will transform whatever spiritual planet, if you will, it drenches, okay? The gospel. It can do no other. Look around you. So many of the good things you have, central heating. Do you hear the heater on downstairs, huh? It's a little chilly in here this morning, but central heating is a product of Western culture, I submit to you, and you're comfortable and toasty warm in here because of it. Ask Mark. Mark can trace, he's got this down too. He can trace one of the benefits, one of the cultural things we enjoy, trace it right back to the nature of the Christianizing of the Western culture. Our Anabaptist brothers and sisters, I love them. But they have long read the Sermon on the Mount, for example, as a call to separate from the larger culture. It is often called the two-kingdom model. There are reform men who have the same position, the idea that rather than that all of the world, wherever the sole of our foot traces, belongs to Christ, belongs to God, there's the two-kingdom model, too, that there are two opposing kingdoms, one of them fallen, one of the devils and the other Christ's. One given over to Satan while the church is Christ's. Under this two kingdom model, our job as Christians is to be the church here and leave the world to go to hell, literally. Waiting until Christ returns to see it transform. Under this two kingdom model that our Anabaptist brothers and sisters, some of my own Reformed brethren, at Presbytery, this two-kingdom model, it's fruitless to try and change and transform this lost larger culture or affect even civil government. Richard Kyle, who's a Mennonite, publishes the magazine Direction for the Mennonites. He says this, "For the Anabaptist separatist, a true Christian cannot occupy a government office. The Anabaptists live quietly and hope for the best." Does that sound like every square foot of this creation belongs to God and to Christ? Hope for the best? Is that the best we can offer to a lost and fallen world? Well, is this the model inculcated here, do you think? Does the suffocating man hold his breath? No, he gratefully breathes in the oxygen, doesn't he? Does the man dying of thirst say, "No thanks, I've gained too much water weight"? No, he drinks that cup of cold water when it's offered to him. So, dear listener, rich spiritual oxygen and nourishing spiritual water have come to planet Ephesus. It is transforming the spiritual landscape of the city, much to the chagrin of Demetrius and his silversmith guild, isn't it? Well, that brings us to their response, verses 28 to 34. But we also see transformation of our world here as well, verses 28 to 34. Impact. The gospel is having an impact here in Ephesus. The gospel cannot help but transform manners and modes of behavior. Okay? The gospel cannot help but transform manners and modes of behavior. See if you can pick up in the narrative here. Once again, Luke is a skilled writer and historian, and he's weaving a contrast between the behaviors of Christians and pagans here in this text. So, as we look to the response of the Ephesians, have you ever heard of a peaceful riot? How about a spiritual gifts mob? A spiritual gifts mob. You know, the spiritual gifts, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. A spiritual gifts mob surging through the streets. You don't see Christians burning cars, smashing store windows, screaming, "Patience, self-control," do you? No. That would be an oxymoron, right? Two contradicting terms. But not so with Demetrius and his union thugs. Now, there's a predominant psychological model that is used to explain mob behavior. It's called the emergent norm theory. Every profession is a conspiracy against the laity, isn't it? Some of these terms. The emergent norm theory. This model says that, 3 points. First of all, when a group of like-minded individuals come together, and B, that group of individuals remain anonymous within the group, very important, because you can shed your personal responsibility for subsequent behavior when you're in the anonymity of a mob, right? And then thirdly, this group has a shared set of passions, gentleness, self-control. That doesn't send you to the ramparts, though, does it? Well, when they have this shared set of passions, then mob behavior is ripe. Demetrius has skillfully tapped this shared set of passions, hasn't he? Arousing them to fever pitch. To the ramparts! Vive la revolution! Huh? Every mob has a mantra to shout, don't they? What's the one from a couple of years ago? We are the 99%, remember? We are the 99%. Where is that from? Yeah, the Putrefy Wall, or the Occupy Wall Street movement, right? We are the 99, down with the 1%. Every mob has a mantra. The silversmiths, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Great is Artemis, and this rolls off the tongue in Greek when you look at it in the text too very nicely. So with this mantra, they surged through the streets of Ephesus to the home of Gaius and Aristarchus, dragging them to the Superdome to make examples of them. Perhaps they wanted Paul the Apostle, but these two Macedonians, non-Asians, foreigners they were as close as they could get. Crowds are dangerous creatures, aren't they? Crowds are dangerous creatures. They do things. People do things in mobs they would never do individually. I love Westerns, don't you? Don't you love the old Westerns, the black and white, the maybe some of the older color ones too? How many Westerns are based on the hanging mob converging on the sheriff's office at night? With their pitchforks and torches, right? They're going to drag out that cattle rustler in order to hang him. But there's John Wayne standing at the door with his Winchester 73, telling them all to go home, right? Let justice take its course. There's no anonymity with John Wayne, right? Luke, I recognize you. You go home to your wife and children now. Fred, I know you. You too, right? In the vigilante mob, that mild-mannered accountant who is a deacon on Sunday will hang a rustler on Sunday night or Saturday night. Luke chronicles the mindlessness of the mob, doesn't he? He says, the city was filled with confusion. That can also be translated tumult, which was true also. Now some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion and most of them didn't know why they'd come together. They say the Bible has no sense of humor. A deliberate contrast is being drawn for you. Some people just like a good riot, don't they? Zev Chaffetz in his book Devil's Night, and Other True Tales of Detroit. Once again, I saw this book. Having grown up in Western Michigan, I grabbed this thing. Well, Zev Chaffetz writes of the legacy of the Detroit race riots in 1967. That legacy is one of riot and destruction. Every night before Halloween in this city, that night is affectionately called in Detroit Devil's Night. In it, fires are set to homes and buildings all over Detroit. People come from all over the world. Japan, Chaffetz interviewed people from Japan and Germany and England, for example. They come to watch Detroit burn all over again. residents of Detroit who rioted in 1967. A lot of them are gray hairs now, grandfathers and grandmothers. They would speak frankly to Chaffetz. They confessed they didn't much care about the reasons for the riots, but that everyone else was doing it and they got swept up in it. Some people just like a good riot. The more things change, the more they stay the same, huh? Behold the pagan passion of the mob. Do you think Christians, if you ever find yourself in a mob, check your soul, okay? Should Christians ever be part of a mob? Well, one of them, Alexander, then, one of the Christians should never be, by definition, members of such company unless they're the targets of the mob. If you're a target of a mob, you're probably doing something right. Okay? Such was Alexander. And he does what is recommended to defuse a mob. That is, confront it without fear. Confront it without fear. Like John Wayne. Alexander didn't have a Winchester 73. Too bad. That's another product of Western culture, too. Guns. Okay? So if you like guns, you better like Christianity. Mark can trace that to you directly from the inculcation of Christianity and culture. So Alexander didn't have his Winchester 73 yet, but he confronts the mob. Paul would have been there himself if not restrained by cooler heads. What happens, though, when they recognize that Alexander is a Jew? Alexander is a Jew. That is, he's a monotheist. He's one of their same kind, right? A monotheist who, by definition, rejects other gods and their images, including Artemis. Well, what the Ephesians do then, they do like all men who cannot speak the truth in a reasonable fashion. They shout their lie with great passion. They cannot speak the truth in a reasonable fashion, so they shout their lie with great passion. Remember the mobs in the state house in Wisconsin? Hours and hours they were yelling their labor union mantras. They still got defeated in the end, but they thought they were right. They thought that they had the conclusive truth. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians! Great is Artemis! They did this for upward of 2 hours. There. That makes it right and true, doesn't it? If so many believe it and believe it passionately enough, ought it not be true? Reconsider if you find yourself in that position. Luke is deliberately contrasting pagan behavior with Christian. He's doing this because all through the Roman Empire, the rumor was that this new sect of Judaism was turning the world upside down. We've seen this already, haven't we? Causing tumult and riot wherever it went. And for many, we have, once again, we have letters even from magistrates, from Roman magistrates, because for many this seemed curious because those who knew Christians knew them to be virtuous souls, characterized by the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. The opposite of what's being displayed here. So, via the narrative, note Luke as a skillful writer. Via the narrative, Luke acquits the reasonable Christians and he shows the real reason for the tumult and riot. That is, it was incited not by anything Christians had done, but by one of the pagans whose self-interests were threatened by an otherwise peaceable faith. And also implicitly recommended for our consideration, or anybody else who might have picked this book up, is the effect that this reasonable faith would have on the Roman Empire. Gaius, Aristarchus, and Paul would not be surging through the streets, setting chariots on fire, breaking out store windows, looting them, and then screaming, peace, patience, self-control, would they? Wherever Christianity went, there was respect for the rule of law and Christian virtues. And I would submit, look about you, Christian. Look about you if you're still in doubt. recall your heritage. And I ask, what is happening to it, huh? We are descending more and more into an Ephesus of the modern day. Well, there is further vindication for the faith then, as one of the Ephesian magistrates enters the Superdome, doesn't he? He quiets these people down. Point three. Verse 35 to 41, verses 35 to 41. Impact. The gospel has an impact on culture, society, law, politics, wherever it goes. Impact. The gospel cannot help but transform justice and government. Separate yourself from, no. Well, Rome loved and prided itself on being an empire of the rule of law. Gens legis is the Latin term for that. Roman law was two-tier. There was the law for the Roman citizen, which was special. That's why it was so special, if you will, to be a Roman citizen, and why Roman citizenship was so highly prized. But there was also a rule of law for the conquered countries, too, the gens legis. Still much better than what the pagans around them were experiencing. So this town clerk is true to form. His speech asserts three things that would appeal to Caesar if he was reading this book, or any other Roman magistrate whose eye would fall upon this text. Three things. Number one, who are you trying to persuade of the obvious? He's saying this to the mobs. Who are you trying to persuade of the obvious? You guys are masters of the obvious. The magistrate implicitly rebukes the mob for its extremes. The whole world was apprised of Ephesus's exalted position as steward of the great goddess Artemis and her cult. What, do you think you've just made it more so by your foolishness? Secondly, he tells them, paradoxically, we are liable to the law rather than the Christians. We are liable to the law rather than the Christians. He warns them, don't do anything foolish. No lynchings, no beatings, no burning chariots and smashing out star windows. He says, we are in danger, right? He puts himself in danger as well. We are in danger of being charged with rioting today. Roman code imposed severe penalties for this kind of behavior, especially upon those inciting riot. Are you listening, Demetrius? And also for those responsible for quelling it, i.e. me, as the town clerk. I'm responsible for quelling riots. There's an implicit threat here. You really want the legions called out today? Do you want these legionnaire riot police, if you will? You want to get them out of bed in a cranky mood? After all, it is not the Christians, he says, who incited this riot with blasphemy or sacrilege. You might have a point to take if that was the case, but rather it was you all, driven by your mob passion, who stand poised to break the law. Thirdly, this town clerk concludes by saying, listen, if a complaint is forthcoming and it has merit, you have recourse to the courts. This especially would be pleasing to a Roman magistrate. If Demetrius can show cause that the Christians have done deliberate economic damage to their trade, then sue, okay? One of the benefits of the Pax Romana, the peace that Rome imposed on the ancient world, was its provision of the gens legis, the law of nations. So do not be so foolish as to despise it and descend into uncivilized mob action to solve your differences. So once again, we have strength for our thesis that Acts is in part a defense brief for the Apostle Paul in Rome before the Emperor Claudius. Where does Acts end? It ends in Rome as Paul is about to go see the Emperor. Throughout the book of Acts, wherever Christians come before previous Roman magistrates, it's consistent here, they're vindicated, aren't they? They're cleared. You should do likewise, is the implicit recommendation to Claudius. And Claudius would, too, if our history is correct. Claudius would vindicate Paul. But later, when old Little Boots, what's his name? Who finally did take off his head. I shouldn't wing it like this, should I? He would later be recaptured and executed. But not by Emperor Claudius. Wherever Christians come before the Roman magistrates in the book of Acts, this will be consistent. They're vindicated. They're cleared. The rumors you hear of them being dissidents is false. They are peaceable, law-abiding citizens. In fact, this region, this very region in which Ephesus was located, would become known throughout history as a place where the rule of law obtained, especially under later Christian emperors, who applied not only the Roman law tradition, but they would do it with Christian principle under the tutelage of the Eastern Orthodox Church and her Bible. The most famous of these were, of course, the Justinian codes, promulgated by Justinian the Great at the ascension of the Byzantine Empire. A rich tradition in the law. These would become a resource for our own Western law tradition, including that of our founding fathers and the Constitution. You can trace a direct line from Ephesus and its emphasis on the law to our own Constitution and founding fathers. Do you yet see the power of the gospel to transform not only souls for eternity, but also culture and society for this temporal realm? The putrefy Wall Street, or the Occupy Wall Street movement may reject and deny this heritage, shouting passionately at the ramparts for days, weeks. We are the 99%. But that doesn't make it so, does it? Vive la revolution! You'll hear that in some countries too. That's a Marxist mantra. And behind that mantra, right after the revolution, comes the dictatorship of the proletariat. So be wary when you hear, we are the 99%. Vive la revolution! So, the gospel transforms, does it not? It is nevertheless true. The truth of the gospel is quietly spoken, however. Jesus said, with what can we compare the kingdom of God? Or what parable shall we use for it? It's like a grain of mustard seed, which, when sown on the ground, is the smallest of all the seeds on earth. Yet when it is sown, it grows up and becomes larger than all the garden plants, puts out large branches so that the birds of the air can make nests in its shade. And Jesus was talking about the nations of the earth when the birds would roost in that bush, in that mustard seed bush, talking about the nations of the earth. Behold the power of the gospel to transform. Look around you. It can transform your life personally, individually, for eternity, when you give yourself to Him in faith, right? This we know. This we agree with our Anabaptist friends and fellow believers. But it is also power to transform this temporal world. As a token, not perfectly, that won't happen until Christ returns, but it will transform our temporal world as a token of that transformed world to come, too. Is this transformation yours? What are you doing not only to inculcate that eternal transformation that takes place in the soul of a believer, but I hope you're working to transform your world around you too. Be conscious of the cultural, societal transformation that the gospel brings too. Okay, brothers and sisters? Well, let us now come to that place where we are transformed by grace in the sacrament of the supper of the Lord.